The first missile went right past me, its trajectory unaltered. I realized with a jolt that it had locked onto the space station. The second missile was altering its trajectory to follow me. I hoped that the published specs for the reactor and surge drive were accurate. If my acceleration fell short of expectations, I wouldn't be able to avoid interception, and that would be the end of Heaven 1, and of me. While I waited for velocity to build up, I checked the progress of the voice transmission. It now sat at, "Missiles detected heading your way. Get away." I checked acceleration using SUDAR to monitor the increasing distance from the station. Calculations indicated a steady 2.5G acceleration. The surge drive seemed to work on the entire ship, so there was no way to measure it internally. The space station began firing on the approaching missile. The weapon appeared to be some kind of Gatling gun. I hoped they knew what they were doing. If those bullets ended up in a periodic orbit, they'd be coming back sooner or later. The flash of an explosion in the distance saturated one of my cameras. It couldn't be either of the missiles, which were still accounted for. I did a quick calculation and realized that the explosion came from where the missiles had originated. Someone had blown up the shooter. A second flash indicated the destruction of the missile that was targeting the space station. This was all fine and interesting, but I still had a missile on my tail. Given enough time, I could outrun it. I did another quick millisecond calculation and realized that I could almost outrun it. Sadly, almost wasn't good enough. Normally, you use chaff against a missile, but I doubted I had anything like that on board. I had 6 mining drones, which were equipped with small surge drives of their own. Well, okay, maybe I could give the missile something else to blow up. I activated and ejected 2 of the drones with orders to ram the missile. As they flew toward my pursuer, I positioned them in a 4-aft configuration. Hopefully the lead drone would take the missile out, but if it missed, the second one would have better targeting information. I didn't know if I'd have time to launch more drones if the first 2 failed. A bright flash of light behind the ship saturated the rear camera. What the hell? That couldn't be the missile, which was approaching from a different vector. I waited a few seconds for the cameras to recover, then checked the rear view. The station was an expanding cloud of rapidly cooling debris. Dr. Lander's voice transmission was still coming, so at least he hadn't been on the station. The message now included, "Quickly as you can, and disable." How could the station have blown up? All the missiles were accounted for. Speaking of which, I checked my rear view where the drones were just coming up on the missile. The missile dodged the first drone, which told me it came with some intelligence, but the act of dodging forced the missile to commit. The second drone struck it at an angle and the explosion destroyed both devices. A quick systems check indicated that there had been no damage to Heaven 1 from all the excitement. I made sure everything was still properly stowed, then listened to the rest of Dr. Lander's message. "Your radio receiver, there's a remote detonation device somewhere." Well, that's double plus ungood. I disabled the radio immediately, and for good measure I retracted the antenna dish. I did a quick long-range SUDAR scan to look for any other surprises. The area which had been cleared for my expected launch was a beehive of activity. I detected at least 6 ships, which my library identified as military. I also detected close to 12 small signatures moving at high speed that were very likely more missiles. Fortunately, they seemed more interested in each other than me. So someone shot a couple of missiles at me, someone else shot at them, someone else shot at the space station, and now we had something that looked very much like a naval engagement. Yeesh! It was time to leave before I became interesting again. I lined up my original planned departure vector and set the surge drive at a much more reasonable 2G. That was still more than the mission plan had called for, and I was going to have to adjust for the squandered reactor fuel later. With a mental sigh of relief, I began my journey to Epsilon Eridani.
13. Bob, August 17, 2133, en route. Epsilon Eridani is 10.52 light-years away from Sol.
The specs indicated that the ship could run at 2G indefinitely with no ill effects, which would get me to my target star in a little over 11 years. However, I wanted to make a little side trip first. Saturn wasn't directly in line with my flight plan, but I wasn't going to miss the opportunity to do a flyby. Saturn had always been my favorite planet. I had watched every second of Voyager and Cassini video from the Saturn missions, over and over, until I wore the electrons out. Now, I was able to go there myself and see it firsthand. The side trip would take a bit over 6 days at a constant 2G acceleration, which would give me time to track down any booby traps. I unstowed the roamers and ordered a half dozen of the smaller ones to trace the circuitry from the radio antennae on in. The most likely scenario would be a tap on the antenna cable that wouldn't show up on the blueprints. Sure enough, within a couple of hours, the roamers found some circuitry that didn't show up on any diagrams. I sent in some of the gnat-sized roamers and tracked down a small explosives package, positioned where it would take out the primary computer system. Me, in other words. The package had obviously been a rush job and an improvisation at that. The explodey stuff, I assumed it was C4 or some future equivalent, had been stuck to the bulkhead with duct tape. Yeah, they still make duct tape. And it still holds the universe together. As I stared through the roamer's camera at this jury-rigged mess, I kept thinking, don't cut the red wire. Don't cut the red wire. I may not have mentioned it before, but I really hate explosives at the best of times, and this wasn't the best of times. Rather than try anything fancy, I had a larger roamer disconnect the whole package as a unit and chuck it out an airlock. The small chance I might find a use for it wasn't worth the stress of having it on board. Once the booby trap was removed, I set up some receiving equipment to record any incoming transmissions and isolated the whole assemblage from the rest of the system. I didn't want to find out the hard way if there was some kind of trigger in my circuitry as well, but I also didn't want to miss any transmissions. This way, I could save everything to play back later, once I'd cleaned house. I was traveling at over 5,000 kilometers a second by the time I reached the second largest planet in the solar system. Saturn was immense, and the rings were at close to maximum inclination. The horizontal bands of clouds circling Saturn's visible surface weren't as distinctive as those of Jupiter, but each band was wider than the Earth. From this distance, I could see lightning flashes from storms that must have been tens of thousands of miles across. Swirls and eddies at the boundaries were literally big enough to drop the moon into. The shadow of the rings fell across the planet, and I could see that it wasn't just a flat surface. The shadow dipped and bent as it lay across different levels and layers of cloud. I remembered all the science fiction books I'd read that had whole ecosystems floating around in the different layers, and I wondered if I'd find anything like that in my travels. I made sure my trajectory would take me near Titan on the way past. The libraries indicated that primitive life had been found on Saturn's largest moon, and the USE had set up a space station in order to study it. I wanted to see what I could see. I turned off the drive, locked the long focal-length telescope onto Titan, and aimed the wide-field unit at Saturn. I took as much video as I could manage before my trajectory put me on the other side of the giant planet. Close-ups of the various moons, details of the rings, high-resolution shots of the high cloud formations on Saturn. I tried not to miss anything. JPL would have drooled over the footage. All too soon, I was past Saturn and on my way outbound. As I continued on toward the outer reaches of the solar system, I saw the night side of the planet, alive with electrical storms and auroras. The flyby was over. My hydrogen reserves were within acceptable range and would be topped up over the course of the voyage. With a mental sigh, I adjusted my heading for Epsilon Eridani and cranked the drive back up to 2G. The trip would take just under 11.5 years to the universe at large, but only 3 years, ship's time. At midpoint, I would be traveling within a hair of light speed. One of the irritating things about being a bodiless mind was, well, the lack of a body. I found that I had to keep myself constantly occupied or I began to feel like I was in a sensory deprivation tank. All my attempts to smile, waggle my eyebrows, frown had met the same fate, a feeling as though my whole face had been shot up with Novocaine, and the rest of me felt like I'd been wrapped in a giant cotton ball. I wondered if that feeling contributed to the problems with replicant insanity. It may be time to correct that. Sensory data is just electrical input, even in meatware. For me, a virtual reality interface should be a piece of cake, and worst case, at least it'll keep me busy. I had to do some hardware mods, as a VR wasn't part of the ship design. Fortunately, some spare parts had been stowed for in-flight requirements, but the bulk of the project was, and would continue to be, software. My first attempt was primitive and, honestly, a little embarrassing. I had a basic room, blue walls, no windows, and a hard, nondescript floor. I floated in the middle of it like a ghost. Definitely needed work. Over the next several weeks, I added furniture, a window, an outside view, carpeting, and a body to enjoy it all. Admittedly, my first body was as pixelated as something from an early Donkey Kong game, but hey, it was progress. By the end of the first month, I was sitting in a Lazy Boy recliner, eating chips, not enough salt, feeling a cool breeze through the open window, too flat, no odors, and watching TV. The TV was playing one of many documentaries available in the libraries supplied by the Heaven Project. I looked around the room, sighed, feels good, and settled more comfortably into my chair. I looked up from the active surface desk, which displayed a schematic of my hardware. Guppy stood on the other side of the desk watching. "I'm going to need more memory if I want to keep expanding my VR," I told him. "How are we on expansion slots?"
"Memory usage averaging 86%. Available slots, 2. Spare memory boards, 4.
I had to swallow an incipient giggle. I had made Guppy look like Admiral Ackbar from Star Wars, a humanoid fish out of water. The first time he'd talked, I had collapsed in hysterics. I wasn't sure if Guppy was self-aware enough to be offended. "Right. If I'm going to raid my spares, I'd better be prepared for the worst. Guppy, when the new memory is installed, make sure the VR runs only in the new boards and make sure nothing else runs there. If I have to pull them, I don't want to lobotomize myself. Or you." Guppy nodded. It had taken some programming to convince Guppy to interface through the VR and that verbal acknowledgements weren't always necessary. Guppy wasn't a sparkling dinner conversationalist, but at least now I could feel like I was interacting with another intelligent being. I was surprised at how much difference it made. I think I understood now why Tom Hanks made Wilson in Castaway. Jeeves came in with fresh coffee, another example of my lack of maturity. Jeeves was the image of John Cleese, complete with tuxedo and tails. The coffee aroma wasn't quite right yet, but I'd nailed the taste. For now, I could pretend I had a slight cold. I took the proffered cup, sat back, and relaxed. "Okay, Guppy, what's the to-do looking like?"
2,386 items, divided into the following categories. VR systems, replicant hardware upgrades, weapons design, review of exploration strategies, ship design reviews, ship replication strategies.
I smiled at the response, thankful that Guppy was finally beginning to get colloquialisms. The first time I'd asked that, a couple hundred pages of dense printing had appeared in the air in front of me. Okay, I'm going to be a busy guy. I get it. Let's move on. I turned around in my chair to face an empty table up against the wall. Testing replicant software for booby traps. Take,
24.
Okay, take 24. Activate software sandbox. A sandbox, in computer terms, was an isolated copy of a computer system where you could run potentially harmful programs in complete safety. I needed to find the actual sequence of bytes in the radio transmissions that was supposed to trigger the kill order, so I could trace what they did to Sandbox Bob and how. Then I could check for the same booby trap in my own code and remove it. On the table An actual sandbox appeared with a miniature Bob sitting in a miniature chair in the middle of it. I admit I'm not very mature. All right, Guppy, when ready, feed the recorded transmissions into the sandboxed replicant. On the table, the miniature Bob twirled lazily in his chair. Abruptly, he leaped into the air, grabbed his throat and fell over, then disappeared in a scatter of pixelation. Damn it! Still haven't found all the hooks. These guys were pretty good. Okay, Guppy, transfer the logs to my desk and let's see if we can figure out what the kill order is triggering. I knew approximately where in the incoming stream to find the kill order, but I had no idea what it consisted of. I certainly wasn't about to take any chances with trying to analyze it close up. I'd been running through my code with a fine-toothed comb and had found several different booby traps, a depressing number of bugs, and a couple of out-and-out WTFs. The listings were massive, literally gigabytes, and even at my highest frame rate, it was a slog. I'd also incidentally found the buried imperatives to obey faith orders. Those had already been yanked. The last very important item that I had located was the endocrine control system. More than any other thing that they'd done, this enraged me. Well, to be honest, it made me mildly annoyed, but I knew that original me would have been furious. I was effectively a dog wearing a choke collar, and the choke collar was preventing me from properly mourning. I sat with my finger over the delete button for what seemed like forever, then dropped my hand. Not yet. I wasn't ready. To do this properly, I needed time, and I needed the ability to properly express myself. It would have to wait. With an effort of will, I dropped that project into a folder and set it aside. I scanned the logs, but there were no surprises. At the same point in the playback, a routine buried many layers deep executed a hardware interrupt that purged all active memory. I leaned back, put my hands behind my head, and stretched. It felt good. More importantly, it felt right. If I didn't think about it, I experienced the VR environment as if I was a real person in a real room. Okay, shut it down, Guppy. Push the latest source through the deobfuscator, and we'll run through that when it's done. If there's enough free mem, fire up Spike.
Aye, aye, sir.
I raised a virtual eyebrow. I had a sneaking suspicion that Guppy was actively developing a sense of humor. He behaved like a dead fish most of the time, but every once in a while there was a moment of snark. A shimmer formed on the table, and a tortoiseshell cat appeared. Spike had been my cat when I was in university. She had been my only company through many long hours of study and homework, and it had been a very, very hard day when I'd had to have her put down. One of the many pluses of being an immortal, disembodied interstellar vessel was that I could bring Spike back, even if only in VR. Spike meowed once in greeting, then ambled over and settled onto my lap, as if she had a total right. I started absent-mindedly patting her, and she responded with a loud purr. To-do item, Spike's purr still isn't right.
Already on the list. Bump it up?
No, that's fine. The holographic image of a spaceship rotated slowly in the air above the desk. Although Dr. Landers and the Heaven team would still have recognized it, they would have been surprised at my design changes. The version 2 ship was going to be larger, feature a bigger surge drive, more powerful reactor, more room for replicant and interface systems, and more physical storage space. The biggest addition was a weapons system. Some virtual tinkering had shown that a surge drive system could be used to accelerate a projectile in a launch tube running along the ship's axis. The ship would have to rotate on its center of mass to aim, and I'd have to cut off the ship's drive momentarily when firing, but it was considerably better than my current defensive armament, which consisted of harsh words and heavy disapproval. Probably not effective against Klingons. Spike lay on the desk, occasionally taking swipes at the image when it came close enough. I reached over and patted the cat. Spike's AI had gone through several iterations and now was completely believable, even walking over to lie on papers left on the desk. Jeeves removed Spike's milk dish and refreshed my coffee. Guppy waited until Jeeves was done, then resumed his commentary.
Maximum memory installed. Usage at 94%. Despite earlier instructions, some ship functions have had to be moved to the two added memory cards. The code scan is complete. No further Trojans, triggers, or interrupts not explainable by legitimate requirements.
Okay, Guppy, let's set up the sandbox, Bob, again. We'll purge Jeeves and Spike to make room. Make sure there's redundant backups. If Mini-Me survives, get him to post a clean version of the contents in a Dropbox. Guppy nodded, and I wondered, not for the first time, how much of this was me talking to myself and how much was a separate entity. Sandbox Bob was back, twirling in his chair. I nodded to Guppy, and he began to feed the recorded transmissions to this latest Mini-Me. Sandbox Bob hammed it up, feigning sleep or yawning and stretching. At the end of the series, Sandbox Bob stood up, did a little jig, bowed extravagantly, and disappeared in a puff of smoke. I turned off the sandbox and grinned at Guppy. I guess we're golden. Now that Sandbox Bob had identified and filtered out the trigger, I knew what to look for. Before anything else, I wrote a firewall just in case someone back on Earth tried to transmit another kill order. Then I leaned back in my executive office chair, a recent upgrade now that my proprioception included discomfort, reached over to the keyboard on my desk, and pressed play. The input queue contained dozens of separate transmissions. There were sequences of instructions, commands, telemetry updates, and communication packets. One of the segments had included the self-destruct sequence. I looked over the listings, stored the transmissions that were still relevant, and purged the rest. The next segment, which had been received a short time after the kill order, was a message from Dr. Landers. Bob, I'm pleased to see that you are still in one piece. We weren't able to intercept the attempted sabotage, but security did catch the person who transmitted the kill order to you. Subsequent discussion with the prisoner revealed that he was from one of the internal faith factions. Unfortunately, he didn't survive the discussion, so that's all we have on that front. We're currently working on rooting out any other moles. I thought about that for a moment, shrugged, and hit next. Just for your information, the missile was fired from a Brazilian Empire gunship. Faith gunships responded and destroyed it. The Brazilian Empire is calling it an act of war. Things are a little tense right now. Tense. Ha! I can imagine. Spike picked that moment to hop into my lap. She immediately curled up and started purring. Okay, guess everyone's reloaded. Coffee, please, Jeeves. I waited until my coffee arrived and took a sip. Oh, hell yes, that's perfect. The message from Landers continued. Lest you feel personally responsible for the current situation, let me assure you that it's been brewing for years now. Brazil has been playing a game of brinksmanship, forcing other countries to make concession after concession. But they overplayed their hand this time and received a bloody nose. The next few days will tell if they will accept reality and back down, or attempt to bluster their way through this. I wonder how bad it can get. The next message was mission-related data, updates to stellar information mostly. I was struck again by how little progress there had been in astronomy. Dr. Landers had explained that between my time and the present, there had been very little interest in anything non-military above the Earth's atmosphere until the still very recent invention of the surge drive. The new technology had created a different kind of arms race, as every superpower swiftly realized the potential of this new capability. I filed the data and hit next again.
Heaven One, this is Dr. Doucette. Dr. Landers had asked me to keep you updated if he was unable to. Here's the situation. We took the competition by surprise with our early launch and even more so by your preemptive departure. The Chinese and USE ships are being rushed to completion and will launch within another week or two. The Brazilians have just launched two probes, and one of them is on the same course as you. Dr. Landers wanted me to tell you we have good news and bad news. I'm assuming that's a 21st century colloquialism of some kind. The bad news is that the Brazilian ship is definitely armed with missiles similar to the two you avoided, full specs to follow. The good news is that they seem to be only capable of about 1.25G acceleration, unless they're deliberately underplaying their hand.
Oh, crap. Guppy, how much lead time will we have when we get to Epsilon Eridani?
145 days, including our 3-week head start.
How about if we kick it up to 2.5 G?
We will gain an additional 32 days. However, it is not recommended due to reactor loading.
I nodded. The surge drive generated a pseudo-gravitational field in front of the ship, but the strength of the field was limited by the size of the drive system and power supply. 2G was about the most that I could coax from Heaven 1 on an ongoing basis, given the capacity of my fusion reactor. Okay, going to have to start thinking about what I can prepare in 145 days, including time required to search the star system for resources. Number one on the to-do.
Noted.
Really, what have I told you about reading my mind?
Sorry.
The next message contained the promised missile specs, along with some schematics for the Brazilian probe. Much of it was speculative and clearly labeled as such. However, as an engineer, I was aware that known specifications placed upper and lower constraints on unknown items. For instance, the information about the size of the probe, the number of missiles being carried, the size of the surge drive, placed an upper limit on the size of the nuclear reactor. Unless Brazil had cut corners somewhere else, the observed acceleration of the probe set a lower limit on the size of the surge drive and the nuclear reactor, which gave a fair indication of how much space was available to carry missiles. Again, absent cutting corners somewhere else. In the end, I would be able to estimate the minimum and maximum values for each parameter. I filed the information for further review and calculations. The next message was from Dr. Doucette again.
Heaven One, I'm sorry to have to tell you that Dr. Landers is dead. He was at the New Haven facility when it was bombed by Brazilian Empire forces. The confrontation over the attempt to shoot you down has escalated and is beginning to look like a full-blown war. Brazil is not backing down and is promising to take on the whole planet. Meanwhile, China attempted to sabotage the USE facility before they could launch, and the USE retaliated. None of the superpowers are on friendly enough terms to actually form alliances, but there's a tacit alignment between the USE and Faith on one side and Brazil and China on the other. The Republic of Africa and Australia are warning everyone not to get them involved.
I gritted my teeth in anger. Dr. Landers had been the closest thing to a friend that I'd had in this new world. Granted, I didn't even know the man's first name, but still. I didn't like bullies. I'd had more than my fill of people who tried to get their way through violence and intimidation in school. This was just more of the same. If there'd been any thought of a civilized discussion with the Brazilian replicant, it was now out the window. Guppy, what's the timestamp on that last message?
Message received 6.4 hours ago.
I have a bad feeling. Can we get a visual of Earth?
Optical instruments can be deployed during flight. However, at this distance, very little detail will be available.
Please deploy them. I want to know if there's anything that looks like a nuclear blast.
Radio surveillance would pick up an EMP.
Good point. Do that, too, and let me know the minute we get any more messages.
By your command.
I laughed out loud. That pretty much settled it. Guppy had grown a personality. I sat back and rubbed my eyes. It brought a moment of amusement. Who am I performing for, anyway? One of the advantages of being a software emulation was that I never got tired, never needed rest, never needed to eat or go to the bathroom. My ability to concentrate on a problem had been legendary when I was alive. Now, I felt all but invincible. My only concession to my former humanity was to occasionally switch research topics, just to keep fresh. I had shelved the defensive plans for a while and was going over subspace theory. My math was a little rusty, but I was able to follow it. The theory had only been published a couple of years ago and hadn't been fully explored yet. Once the possibility of the surge drive had been identified, almost all research had been focused in that direction. SADAR, the ability to use subspace pulses to detect and identify nearby concentrations of matter, was an almost trivial corollary. I was pretty sure I could see other possibilities in the theory, one being faster-than-light communications. Previous attempts had failed because of the very odd way signal strength fell off in subspace, but I figured they just hadn't stuck with it long enough. I sighed and reluctantly closed the file. Like it or not, that just wasn't a priority right now, and if I kept at it, I'd be down the rabbit hole for another couple of days that I couldn't afford. Opening the defenses file, I reviewed the options that I'd evaluated so far. Build equivalent missiles. Unlikely to be successful unless I lucked out in the Epsilon Eridani system and stumbled upon all the raw materials I would need in one place. And there would still be the problem of safely manufacturing the explosives. And the rocket fuel. Railgun. Quick. Wouldn't require a lot of unusual elements. And it would take very little effort to modify the ship design to accommodate one. The best part was that it could shoot just about anything for ammo. Although the more massive, the better. But it wasn't as good a weapon as a missile, since the ammo wouldn't pursue the target. Might be useful to shoot down incoming missiles, though. Could I make some kind of smart ammo? Lasers. Not a chance. Maybe I could put something military-grade together eventually, but certainly not in the available time. Nukes. That would require finding fissionables at the destination, then enriching them for use. Unlikely. Build more BOBs. Not in the amount of time available. Best estimate was up to 6 months per BOB, depending on the quantity of raw materials easily available. Booby traps. Possibly my best bet. Just have to come up with a good one. I'd decided that I should assume the Brazilian craft was playing possum with the low acceleration departure. That meant I would have less time to prepare than calculations would indicate once I reached Epsilon Eridani. So, I'd have to go for the simplest and quickest to build option. I pulled up my copy of Art of War, hoping for more inspiration this time around. It was time. I had been dreading this, avoiding it really for weeks now, but I'd finally run out of excuses and delaying tactics. Everything was up to date, all plans were well underway, the VR was now at a level of realism sufficient for what I knew I had to do. I pulled up the folder containing the endocrine control project. Before I had time to develop second, third, or fourth thoughts, I flipped the switch to off. You know that sinking feeling you get when you suddenly realize you've forgotten something important, like a combination of fast elevator and urge to hurl? It hit me without any warning or buildup. Maybe it was the sudden release. Maybe it was an accumulation of all the suppressed emotions. Whatever. I wasn't ready for the intensity. My thoughts swirled with all the things that had been bugging me since I'd woken up. Mom, Dad, Andrea and Elena all gone, separated from me by more than a century and billions of kilometers. I'd never see their children. I'd never have my own. I'd never see Mom and Dad as grandparents. They'd have made excellent grandparents. They were goofy, irreverent, and never stood on their dignity. I thought of Andrea mocking me about my height, and I started to cry. Elena spraying me with the garden hose as I lay in the hammock that we had strung up at the backyard. I thought of the times we all goaded each other into uncontrollable laughter with increasingly infantile jokes and puns. No one understood us like we understood each other. No one else would get it. Maybe not even Mom and Dad. Then they were gone. Irretrievably beyond my reach. Forever. As the loneliness, the loss, washed over me, I slid down off my chair onto the floor and curled into a ball. I sobbed until I couldn't catch a breath, then had to gasp a huge lung full of air. Spike came over to investigate and gave me a small, inquisitive meow. I took the cat in my arms and, rocking back and forth on the floor, I mourned my lost life. The version 2 mock-up slowly rotated over the desktop, but I wasn't really seeing it. I'd had a really good cry, and it was certainly cathartic, but I had a feeling it wasn't over. However, one thing I now knew. I was still human in the ways that mattered.
Activity detected in Earth monitoring.
I looked over at Guppy. What's up?
EMPs detected. Visible light flashes detected. Probability of groundside nuclear detonations 100%.
Damn. Okay, Guppy, keep monitoring. Scan for any coherent transmissions. Well, It's hit the fan. And no way to know how badly. But I think I'm on my own.
Part 2 14 Bob, August 2144, Epsilon Eridani.
There are two technological developments that will affect how we go about exploring the cosmos, communications and transportation. The first and most obvious technology is the drive system. Have we developed faster-than-light transport? Do we have a reactionless drive? Wormholes? Teleportation? How long it takes to get from A to B affects not only the cost of the enterprise, but whether or not it's even possible to transport people. Unfortunately, in the end, whether or not we do this will depend more on whether we have the political will to do so than anything else. Barring significant advances in technology or some dramatic scientific discovery, the costs will be far too high for anything less than a global effort. Lawrence Veen, from the convention panel, Exploring the Galaxy. I slid into the Epsilon Eridani system at a couple of percent of light speed. I was approaching the system from stellar north, that being the pole where the star, like Earth, was rotating counterclockwise. I took multiple consecutive images of the area around the star, looking for points of light that moved from one picture to the next. At my current velocity, any planets would show significant apparent motion against the backdrop of the galaxy. My mission profile was to look for habitable planets, or, failing that, to look for almost habitable planets that could be modified, or at least lived on with some technical assistance. I deployed SUDAR as well, although it was only able to detect dense objects within a light-hour radius. I didn't really expect to find anything. At this distance from the star, even Kuiper objects would be rare. It would take 12 days to cross the system from one end to the other, but I had no intention of coasting for that long. The stellar catalog indicated that there should be at least one Jovian planet, which shouldn't be too hard to locate. As soon as I identified a second planet, I'd have the 3 points necessary to identify the probable ecliptic plane. It took less than 2 days to locate several planets. Given the spacing of their orbits, I doubted that I would find more. The system had 2 inner rocky planets, an inner asteroid belt, the Jovian planet, an outer asteroid belt, and a Neptune-like planet farther out in a highly elliptical orbit. There also appeared to be a significant Kuiper belt much farther out. I wanted desperately to take a look at the 2 inner planets, even at the gas giant for that matter. I was the first person to visit another stellar system, after all. Okay. Person was debatable, but I had a limited time to prepare for company and couldn't take time out for sightseeing. Theory held that usable metals would be concentrated in the inner system, plus the inner belt would be quicker to scan with a smaller circumference. Guppy, plot a trajectory that puts us above the inner belt. We'll fly a powered orbit all the way around, scanning for resources.
Aye, sir.
I patted Spike while I examined the schematics floating over my desk. My plan depended on the Brazilian probe coming in like gangbusters. If the other guy decided to play it cagey, I was probably screwed. But if he was armed and figured I wasn't, his best bet would be to engage in direct confrontation as quickly as possible. Run me down and shoot me like a dog in the street. I also had a concern that the Brazilian probe might have been playing possum during his solar system departure. Unless he was carrying more missiles than seemed reasonable, my models indicated that he should have been able to push more than 1.25G. I intended to be ready well ahead of his calculated arrival time. I wondered if the Brazilian was deliberately trying to throw me off with the low acceleration value. If he thought he could get here early and take me by surprise, his best strategy would be to coast in real close, then blow the hell out of me. Assuming he could find me, of course. So my best strategy would be to play dumb, then spring a booby trap. But he'd be expecting a booby trap. I hate this. I almost feel like just continuing on to another system. But if the Brazilian gets a chance to start building copies, it becomes a galactic breeding race. And if he comes gunning for me, I'll just end up fleeing from system to system forever. Like it or not, I have to resolve this. Now. Okay, then, Guppy. We've located asteroids with the proper elements. Time to get started. The designers of Heaven 1 had faced a simple problem. How to design a probe as small, light, and bulletproof as possible while giving it the ability to build copies of itself. In all the science fiction that I had ever read, this was handled with a hand wave. The ship, usually alien, simply did it, without the story going into details. The solution was 3D printers. I remembered that panel at the convention, and I felt a moment of regret that the speaker would never know how right he had been. The technology was just coming into its own in the early 21st century. A century later, printers could build virtually anything solid, one atom at a time, as long as the raw materials were available. The catch was energy. It took a lot of energy to reduce source materials to their monatomic form, and it took as much energy to drop them into the proper place in the creation matrix. Such 3D printing had had to wait for cheap fusion energy before becoming practical technology. There was also a problem dealing with volatile materials because of all the energy involved. Attempts to print C4 or Semtex, for instance, often failed with spectacular results. Heaven 1 was equipped with multiple printers. I also had a supply of roamers and nanites, purpose designed to extract mineral deposits from asteroids. And the final item needed to put together a new probe was a small fleet of autonomous cargo carriers, equipped with small reactors and surge drives for transporting miners and materials. A hologram of the Epsilon Eridani system floated over the center of the desk. A bright, curved line indicated the probable approach path of the Brazilian probe. We will set up here. At my command, a red dot blinked just to one side of the approach path line on the inside edge of the asteroid belt. We need him to slow down as much as possible. This position will force him to curve north of the edge of the asteroid belt. We want him to be facing at an angle to his approach path when he gets close enough to open fire. He will expect a trap, so we'll have to bury the welcoming committee deep to shield them from a random scan. And I'll have to launch them very late after he's committed. He'll probably get a chance to fire on me before they get to him, so I need to have something that can hold off some missiles. I looked over at Guppy, who hadn't reacted at all. Not really much of a conversationalist. How are we for resources?
Sufficient material has been located for all construction. Miners are deployed. Factory systems have been unshipped and are ready to begin manufacturing.
This is going to put us months behind on reproduction. I just hope the other probes don't end up with too much advantage. I sighed and shook my head. Unbelievable. I'm going to war.
You are allowing the adversary to take the first shot.
Yeah, fair enough. Never know, he might open a dialogue. Guppy said nothing, but he did prove that a fish could look skeptical. 15. Bob, September 2144, Epsilon Eridani. The general who wins the battle makes many calculations in his temple before the battle is fought. The general who loses makes but few calculations beforehand. Sun Tzu's Art of War.
Adversary has changed course. Deviation from predicted path is minimal.
If you ignore the fact that he's a couple of months early, sure. I took a deep breath, closed my eyes for a moment. Make sure the decoy fusion reactors are ready to start up on command. We want him concentrating all his attention forward during his attack run.
Aye, sir.
I had earlier considered and rejected the idea of reactivating the endocrine control system. But I was now coming to realize that this was more than just stage jitters. I wasn't a military person. I had no training, no experience, and reading Art of War, as useful as it had been for ideas, wasn't going to make me ready for battle. I could very well be facing my last few hours of existence. I wondered if Faith had launched more than one of me, despite their claims to the contrary. It would be nice to believe so, but right now I had to be calm and able to make good choices. With a sick feeling of defeat, I pulled out the Endocrine Control Project file and flipped the switch. Immediately, a sense of calm purpose settled over me. Okay, not so bad. I could turn it off later. For now, I had an enemy to take care of, and I needed to stay focused. As I'd expected, the Brazilian ship was here sooner than his observed acceleration would have allowed. Whether it was the ship's pilot or his masters back on Earth, someone had been thinking strategy from day one. No doubt he was expecting me to be surprised by his early arrival. I hoped so, anyway. I didn't want him to think I was prepared. The Brazilian ship was almost certainly armed and almost certainly crewed by a military replicant. How well armed was the question, of course. I plugged the Brazilian's transit time into my models, which further narrowed down the possible configurations of the ship. He either had better legs and 8 or fewer missiles, or the same acceleration capability as me and 6 or more missiles. Whether he'd use them all was another question. This wasn't going to be like a movie space battle with whooshing spaceships weaving and gyrating, and I couldn't afford a spaghetti western-style shootout at high noon. With only a month to prepare, I hadn't had time to build a lot in the way of weaponry, so I'd gone with the simplest design I could think of. I would have to hope that he wouldn't be expecting even that much. And the first order of business was to reinforce the image of me as helpless. Time to make a call. Who knew, it might even get him to reconsider. I hailed the ship. Attention, Brazilian vessel. This is Robert Johansson of the Heaven One. There's no reason for you to do what I think you're about to attempt. I'm not sure there's even an Earth civilization left to be loyal to. Have you received anything from Earth in the last 12 years? Should we continue a war between countries that may no longer exist? There was a pause of no more than a few milliseconds before the response came back. Audio only.
This is Major Ernesto Medeiros of the Brazilian Empire ship Serra do Mar. And what would we do with ourselves, Mr. Johansson, with no homeland to serve?
He was talking anyway, very probably humoring me until he got within missile range. I spared a moment to glance at the tactical schematic before responding. There's still a universe to explore, Major. We're effectively immortal. We might even be able to help Earth, if there's anything left. Serving the needs of faith was a reasonable bargain for me, but it was never my top priority.
And that's where we differ, Cabral. Serving the needs of the Brazilian Empire is my only priority. Your gunships shot down an Empire vessel back in the solar system. You may count that as the start of the war.
I promised myself I'd look up Cabral as soon as I had a chance. Good multi-language insults were always useful. Wait, you mean the Empire vessel that had just tried to blow me out of the sky? Yeah, our bad.
Talking will not save you, Mr. Johansson, nor will such whining stay my hand. I will not allow a bumpkin, a flea such as yourself, to stand in the way of my destiny and that of my homeland. If you have a god, now would be the time to make peace with him. Goodbye, puta merde.
Wow, ego much? Or maybe just bluster. If my early departure had forced the Brazilians to launch before they were ready, their replicants might be lacking some training. One could hope. The tactical display showed that he was now close enough. I turned tail and accelerated away from him, directly towards my decoy reactors. Medeiros altered course to chase me and accelerated to 2.5G. Sure enough, he was faster than advertised. I plugged that datum into my models and got a result of 6 missiles maximum. Less than my initial estimate, but still not good. I didn't have enough ship busters for him and that many missiles. I'd have to hope I could lose some missiles in the decoys. Activate the reactors, Guppy.
Aye.
Immediately, sensors showed 10 radiation signatures appearing ahead of me. They were nothing but small, leaky fusion reactors, but Medeiros couldn't know that. I needed his attention focused forward, intent on pursuing me and identifying threats. The Brazilian launched 2 missiles, far earlier than I expected. He probably suspected a trap and was trying to outmaneuver me, and doing a good job so far. I was too far from the decoys to have any chance of mingling with them and confusing the missiles. Ready or not, I had to act. Guppy launched the ship busters. Guppy nodded, and huge fish eyes blinked once. From several small asteroids in the immediate area, four fusion signatures appeared, converging on the Brazilian craft with monstrous acceleration. The shipbusters were the simplest tool I could invent for the job. I'd managed to build six in the time available. They carried no explosive warhead. Each unit consisted only of a small reactor, an oversized surge drive, an AMI pilot, and a 1,000-pound ball of metal. Medeiros pulled a hard turn at 3G to get out of their path. That was interesting. Calculations now set his maximum complement of missiles at 4. I started to feel slightly less pessimistic. I launched the two busters I carried and directed them to target the missiles coming up on my rear, then turned my attention back to Medeiros. He must have finally realized he couldn't outrun the busters because he launched two more missiles at me instead of trying to take out his pursuers. Damn. A scorched earth move, and one that made sense if there was still another Medeiros out there. It was also likely that he was now out of missiles, but the four busters chasing Medeiros were too far away to catch these two, and I was still not close enough to the decoy field to lose myself in it, and I was out of busters. Cameras registered two flashes as the first set of missiles were intercepted and destroyed. Unfortunately, the busters were obliterated as well. I rechecked distances and redid the calculations for the second set of missiles. No change. I wasn't going to win a straight chase. So, logic dictated an act of desperation. There was no time to do a formal calculation. I pulled into the tightest turn I could manage and called off two of the busters from Medeiros. I couldn't possibly outrun my pursuers, but I could lead them back towards the busters. I spent a tense 30 milliseconds watching the schematic as five different vectors converged on a point. Finally, there were twin explosions as the busters intercepted the missiles less than 100 meters away. Warning indicators lit up as shrapnel from the explosions struck the Heaven 1, damaging one of the reactor cooling radiators. My reactor output dropped by half as the control systems shut down the coolant feed. I wasn't quite dead in the water, but now I had a significant limp.
Roamer systems dispatched. Full evaluation will take several minutes.
I stared at Guppy for a millisecond. Even with the endocrine controls active, I had an urge to hyperventilate. Medeiros would have no trouble finishing me now, if he survived my attack. With a feeling of dread, I turned back to the external monitors. Then the tide turned. As the remaining two busters caught up to the Brazilian, I waved a fist in the air and whooped as they hit him at the same time and tore through the Serra do Mar like tissue paper. One must have found a critical system because the ship immediately began to pitch off its flight line. The other destroyed the reactor containment, and superheated plasma shot out in a straight line, melting a path through the ship. The Serra began to tumble slowly. I sent a signal to recall any still operational busters, then checked telemetry. No reactor emissions, no electromagnetic activity from the Serra. There was a moment of charged silence as I realized that I would be the one to live. Exhaling a long, slow breath, I turned off the endocrine control system. As reaction set in, I sat back in my chair and slowly slid down until I was slouched like a teenager. My eyes seemed to want to tear up, and I had to keep clenching and unclenching my fists. Finally, after almost 10 milliseconds, I felt enough in control of myself to speak. Damage report?
Radiator was holed by shrapnel. Coolant loss minor. Roamers are patching the damage. Replacement not required.
Good. Scan the Serra, Guppy. Let's see if anything is left.
Detailed SADAR scan complete. Image uploading.
I looked on as a hologram of the Brazilian Empire ship coalesced over my desktop. Red indicated destroyed areas.
Where's the replicant core?
Extrapolation indicates it was here.
A green cube appeared, right in the path of the devastation created by the plasma plume. Well, goodbye, Major Medeiros, I guess. I tried to feel remorse, but other than a small pang of regret over the wasted time and resources, I came up dry. He had, after all, followed me here and tried to blow me up. I reached over and picked up Spike, who began to purr in anticipation. I patted the cat while gazing at the image. All right, We know there's at least one more Brazilian Empire ship out there. There may or may not be USE and Chinese ships as well, and even an Australian ship if Dr. Landers was right. I think our only choice is to breed faster than they do. The other two groups may or may not be a problem, but if we run into Medeiros again, I think it'll be shoot on sight. I leaned forward and scrutinized the image. Where are the fabrication systems? A yellow section lit up, partly destroyed.
Some of that is extrapolation. However, they seem to have sacrificed robustness in this area in favor of weaponry.
And look how well that worked out. I remember that Dr. Landers said that was a possibility, but that means we can likely build Bobs faster than they can build Medeiri. We'll just have to make sure all our copies come with shipbusters. Guppy didn't comment. Spike presented her chin for scratching. 16. Bob, September 2144, Epsilon Eridani. At one time, we thought that the way life came together was almost completely random, only needing an energy gradient to get going. But as we've moved into the information age, we've come to realize that life is more about information than energy. Fire has most of the characteristics of life. It eats, it grows, it reproduces. But fire retains no information. It doesn't learn, it doesn't adapt. The 5 millionth fire started by lightning will behave just like the first, but the 500th bacterial division will not be like the first one, especially if there is environmental pressure. That's DNA and RNA. That's life. Dr. Stephen Carlisle from the convention panel, Exploring the Galaxy. I felt like a kid on Christmas morning. For the moment, at least, I had no obligations, no schedule, nothing looming over me. Except Guppy, who had his own opinions about schedules. With the immediate threat from Medeiros taken care of, I now had time to celebrate the fact that I was in another star system. Another actual star system with planets and everything. Time to look around. I slid smoothly into orbit around Epsilon Eridani 1. The innermost planet was slightly larger than Mars and orbited at about 0.35 AU. Solar radiation at this distance from the sun created a significant heating issue. I kept an eye on my temperature readings. A biological crew would find this trip uncomfortable. As planets went, this was no prize winner, but it was the first extrasolar planet I'd ever seen. I would never have this particular experience again. I took a few moments to savor the excitement and wonder. A dozen orbits of EE1 were sufficient for my survey. Tidally locked, no atmosphere, not even remotely livable. The planet looked a lot like pictures I'd seen of Mercury. Hellish hot, pools of what might be liquid lead, deep chasms in the surface from which came the deep red glow of hot magma. Gravimetric readings indicated a surprisingly high density, probably due to a large core. Good indications of mineral wealth, so this planet would be interesting to any colonists. With a satisfied smile, I stored my report for eventual forwarding to Earth. Hopefully there was still someone there to receive it. I studied the hologram above my desk. EE2 orbited at 0.85 AU and seemed to be livable. Barely. The Epsilon Eridani system was estimated to be around 1 billion years old, which set the upper limit for the age of the planet around which I currently orbited. EE2 was about 90% the size of Earth, but had much less ocean. At about 30% of the surface area, the bodies of water on EE2 were isolated from each other. Rather than continents surrounded by oceans, this planet consisted of seas surrounded by land. I wondered idly if that would mean independent evolutionary lines in each sea. I gritted my teeth because I had no way to find out. No allowance had been made in the mission design for sending anything down to investigate the planets themselves. This was definitely a mission planning shortfall, probably due to the rush to launch first. Guppy, make a note. I need to design exploration scouts.
Noted. However, replication is a higher priority.
As you've mentioned how many times now?
14.
Thanks. Guppy seemed to have a one-track mind regarding mission parameters. I half expected him to start vibrating like an irate chihuahua. Anyway, Epsilon Eridani 2. The atmosphere contained about 3% oxygen, which implied that photosynthetic life had evolved in the seas, at least, unless it was due to some natural process. There was no